know, it's going to be really difficult. Most of your children are growing up in a world much different than the world that a lot of us grew up in. I grew up in a world where at breakfast I might have a bowl of cereal, and the cereal box would be sitting there in front of me, and it would have this certain athlete on the cover of that particular cereal box, because he was the epitome of manhood during the time, because he had won all these events in the decathlon and was looked upon as being so wonderful and so great. This was the ultimate male specimen when it came to athletics during the time. Now he wears dresses and is on the cover of Glamour magazine, because he's went from Bruce Jenner to Caitlyn Jenner. I grew up seeing Bruce. Your children are growing up seeing Caitlyn. That's a short period of time, relatively speaking. Our young men are being taught that young men are awkward, they're aggressive, rapists, and that you should fear for your daughters being around them, because 1 in 4 college students that are girls are sexually assaulted going through college, which is a bogus number, by the way. However, we're told that all men are that way. Our young boys are being taught that the world would be better if men were not in charge, because women would be better about coming together and being peaceful and talking through and making easy resolutions for all the issues that are going on in the world. That men are not equipped for that because they're too aggressive and too headstrong. That guys don't know how to communicate. And that girls are better. Our guys are being taught in school that they didn't get in touch with their feminine side. Guys, you don't have a feminine side. If you do, there's some studying that needs to go on. You don't have a feminine side. You're a guy. God created you that way. Be proud to be created the way that you are. We're told that there's not a big difference, really, between men and women, so we shouldn't be emphasizing those, except for this one big difference: women are better. And that's what society tells us. And it's invading the church. And it's not meant to be that way. Men, we should be proud that God created us as men. We should not be embarrassed or be ashamed of the fact that we are masculine as God intended for us to be, and that we exhibit that. And it's going to be exhibited in a lot of different ways, and sometimes it is going to be misunderstood, but we need to understand those roles that are given to us. Because in the Scriptures you do have that God did give the man certain roles. He gave the man to be the fathers, the heads of the families. It's a little bit different that you have a father who is that person in the household, who is that oldest male who, you know, fathered the children that are there. But even in the Scriptures, you see that many times the father was also not just the father of his particular household, but an entire lineage or a group of people. You have in the very beginning in Genesis where you have certain fathers who had children, and these children became these cities and these towns and these places that were known for such things as being able to work with metal or doing other certain types of work or industry or whatever. And it lasted throughout the generations. In the verses that were read for us, I selected that because it talks about Abraham and how Abraham is the father of the faithful. But you notice that one of the things it says, the New King James says in verse 19, that God says, "For I have known him." The ESV has a little bit better rendering of that when it says that "I have chosen him." But God chose him because of the intimacy that is there. That's why those two different words are used. I have known him. I know the kind of man he is. I've chosen him because of the fact that I know him. And this is what he says about him, that he may command his children, but not just his children, but his household after him, that they keep the way of the Lord to do righteousness and justice, that the Lord may bring to Abraham what he has spoken to him. God had given Abraham these promises because he knew the kind of man that Abraham was, and that Abraham's lineage would be the type of people who would maintain that same level of faithfulness. That's who we are today. And it's because of that lineage, that father Abraham that we have, that we're here today, and that God was able to accomplish his purposes. But God gave that role to the man. Elders, prophets, priests. When you go through the scriptures, God is constantly choosing men for these particular roles. In Titus chapter 1, verses 6 through 9, I just want to read these in your hearing. Titus 1, 6 through 9. In choosing someone to be qualified as an elder, notice that in Abraham, the kind of qualifications that was there for fathers. Here, verses 6 through 9, if a man is blameless, the husband of one wife, having faithful children, not accused of dissipation or insubordination, for a bishop, an elder, a presbyter, must be blameless as a steward of God, not self-willed, not quick-tempered, not given to wine, not violent, not greedy for money, but hospitable, a lover of what is good, sober-minded, just, holy, self-controlled, holding fast the faithful word as he has been taught, that he may be able by sound doctrine both to exhort and convict those who contradict. God chose men as prophets, priests, elders in the church to be these leaders because these are the kinds of characteristics God expects among them. And it has a specific purpose. These qualifications are there that he may be able to accomplish the work that God gave the man to do. Your husband, ladies, was created to be able to do these things. It is within his power. It was a role that was given to him. And yes, it is true that women are even supposed to have some of these same traits, but you don't have it the same way that men have it because the purpose is different. The purpose that it was given to me and other men is for that role of leadership, for that role of preservation of truth, and fighting the battles that God gave men the distinct ability to do within us. Also, rulers, commanders, sort of along that same line, and soldiers. God, in His Word, when people were chosen to do these certain things, He chose men to do these things. In Deuteronomy 20 and verse 8, there's an interesting passage of Scripture. Deuteronomy 20 and verse 8. And the priests are asking these questions of the people. And the officers, it says, the officer shall speak further to the people and say, what man is there who is fearful and faint-hearted? Let him go and return to his house, lest the heart of his brethren faint like his heart. It wasn't a commendable thing. God expected men to carry these roles because men are going to be the ones who, generally speaking, are the more daring, more equipped to go into these roles and not be afraid. That's why you may see a girl when she's doing certain things, she may be very timid and very easy when she's doing certain things. The boy's just going to walk off the edge of the stage. If he hits his head, he just hits his head. He doesn't think much about it. And the reason being is not because he doesn't have intelligence. It's just that guys usually are a little more daring, a little more risk-taking than girls are. It's just the way things are. And God gave these roles to men because they're not to be faint-hearted. Guys, you're not supposed to be fearful about certain things. The reason being is because if you're fearful, it's contagious. And it causes other people to be fearful as well. God gave the role of judges and teachers to men. In Exodus 18, in verse 21. Exodus 18 and verse 21. Moreover, you shall select from all the people. This is Moses' father-in-law telling him about selecting other judges to help out with the work. Moreover, you shall select from all the people able men. Notice these qualifications. Able men such as fear God, men of truth, hating covetousness, and place such over them to be rulers of thousands, rulers of hundreds, fifties, rulers of tens, and so forth. One of the things that you'll notice that when you go through these particular ideas, God gave men these roles. However, most of them are not about qualifications as far as the task as it is qualifications of character. And that's interesting to me. Moses wasn't told to find people who have already been doing these jobs in other areas. In the New Testament, Acts chapter 6, when it talks about these men who are going to wait on these tables, as it were, to see this daily distribution of goods, it doesn't say select men who have been doing this in their businesses. Select men full of faith in the Holy Spirit. So men, it's about having certain characteristics that enables you to do that work. That's what God intends. Now, when you go back to the beginning and you start thinking then, what are some of these characteristics of men? Are they strengths or are they weaknesses? Because many times these things that we look at that God has given to us that are supposed to be great strengths can actually have some adverse effects. I want us to first go to Genesis and see how it is that men were created. Genesis 1, verses 27 and 28. Just as a reminder, this is before the downfall of mankind. Genesis 1, 27. So God created man in his own image. That word man there is referring to mankind in his own image. In the image of God, it clarifies, in the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. All right? So God in the beginning made man and woman both in his image. Not just the man, but the man and the woman. Then God blessed them, and God said to them, not just the man, but to the woman as well, be fruitful and multiply. Obviously, the guy can't do that by himself, right? So he says that to both. But then also notice this. God says to both the man and the woman, fill the earth and subdue it. Have dominion over the fish of the sea, birds of the air, every living thing that moves on the earth. The man and the woman were both given that task and that right. Now, chapter 2 gives a little bit of a greater insight into what that looked like. So chapter 2 of Genesis in verse 18, it says this, and the Lord God said, it is not good that man should be alone. I will make him a helper comparable to him. So when he made the woman, he didn't make the woman to have the same thing that the man had in chapter 1, to subdue the earth, to have that same thing. We've looked at that word helper before, that word helper does not mean that she is someone who is his servant or his helper in the sense that she brings him the tools that he needs to do the job that only he can do. That's not the idea. It's the same word that's used for God, that God is a very present help in time of need. And this help, this rescuer, comes to the aid because she is comparable. She is like him. She is equal to him, is what it literally means. She is suitable for that task. That's how God created man and woman. But then you get to chapter 3. And in chapter 3, you have that they partake of the fruit of the tree. They sin. And if you go down to verse 16, that God says this to the woman, I will greatly multiply your sorrow and your conception. In pain you shall bring forth children. Notice this, it says to the woman, your desire shall be for your husband. It was created within the woman at that particular time, it seems to me, this thing that's a curse in a lot of ways, and at this time it especially was, your desire will be for your husband. You will look to him to fulfill what you have lost through your sinfulness. And the thing that was taken away from you was a sense of security, a sense of worth and value, and a sense of love. And you only find fulfillment in that from the man. Your desire will be for him. The man, it says, shall rule over you. That man is now cursed with this innate need and desire to rule over and to be respected and honored. And he does not feel fulfilled until he gets it. But he cannot get it from only himself. He gets that from his wife, his companion. And so God created us so that we might fulfill this need that we have that can only be fulfilled by the other. And so we go through this cycle. And so with the man, what does that look like? That looks like respect. Men are about respect. We want to be respected and honored for the decisions that we make. Men are very goal-oriented. In other words, we think about what is the goal of something. We're not really interested a lot of times in all these little details. I've got a goal in mind. There's something that I want to accomplish, and that is what I'm looking forward to. I want control over things. I don't like giving that up to someone else. I want to be able to control it. Give me the ball, because if we're going to win the game, you got to give it to me. And in the workplace, it's kind of that way. I want control over the situation. Men are very black and white in their thinking. You know, we don't try to think a lot of abstract different ideas and all these other things that are going on. It's either yes or no. It's either right or it's wrong. It's either left or it's right. We don't get abstract. What's black and white about it? We're blunt in that way. We're very linear in our logic, in our thinking. We don't go down the other roads. I want to go from point A to point B. And so when you come to me and say, well, I'm trying to get here, I say, well, this is the way that you go. Yes, but isn't there a store of the way? I don't care if there's a store along the way. You want to go there, that's how you get there. And a lot of times, that's why we have arguments and confrontations with others. It's because we're very linear in our thinking. We focus on the facts. We don't really care a lot about the emotions that are involved in it. We're just only interested in what is the fact about those particular things. We tend to be, the guy speaking tonight may not be, but emotionally stable. That means that we value that we can go through a situation or see others go through a situation and it doesn't get them emotional. And so that's one of the things that inherently that we hold on to. We also tend to think about what is said is a lot more important than how it is said. And so when you look at that as men, is that a strength or is that a weakness? Yes. Because you can see that every one of those things, that when it comes to leadership, when it comes to getting something accomplished and making sure things are going to have integrity behind them, those are strengths. Men, thank God, we have so many men who have these characteristics. But brothers, let us be careful. Because a goal-oriented man, or a man who demands respect, can become very proud and become very self-centered. A man who is goal-oriented, who's focused on accomplishment, becomes a man who is interested only in winning and has a lot of disrespect for a loser. A man who wants control is also a man who wants to dominate many times. A man who is very black and white in his thinking, who prefers logic, is a man who also always wants to be right. It's going to make sure that he is. A man who is very linear in his thinking often, and I find this in myself a lot, becomes very impatient and not very tolerant for people who are indecisive or hesitate about doing the right thing. That men usually are the kind of people who focus on just the external, the facts, the events of something. But that can make us very callous to the real human concerns that others have. That stability when it comes to emotions can cause us to suppress our emotions and seize emotions as a weakness. A man who's only interested in what is said can become very brutish in his speech and in his manner. You think about some of the people in the scriptures that were described as being these macho men. Think about Esau. He was a hunter, right? Jacob liked to stay in the tent. Orr and I would laugh about that a lot because it was that idea. He was that mighty hunter. He would go out there in the field. He would kill the game. He'd bring it home, you know, and it's time for the time to eat. I've got my meat on the table. And Jacob liked to stay in the tent. They were two different guys. But you also remember how Esau was when it came to he was willing to sell his birthright so that he could get something to eat right then. He's very impatient, impetuous, and fleshly oriented. You think about other men like King Saul, who was head and shoulders above all these other people and looked like somebody who ought to be the king, and yet he was the kind of person who became so insecure, it seems, that he was wanting to kill David. Samson? I mean, the epitome of manhood in the scriptures, if you think about it in the physical sense, and yet you think about how weak he was when it came to physical things, fleshly things. And there are so many others that we could mention. We could mention Rehoboam, who wouldn't even listen to the older men, because how do you gain respect? How do you get the people to serve you acceptably? Rehoboam says, and his cohorts say, his young other male companions say, crush them. That's how you get their respect. Brethren, that's not how you get respect. It's never been God's intention for us to get respect through those methods at all. And so Galatians 5, 22 through 24, if you'll turn there quickly. Galatians 5, 22 through 24. When Paul goes through these different fruits of the Spirit, or this fruit of the Spirit, notice what it is. The fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, long-suffering, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. Against such there is no law. All these things you see on the screen that are inherent about being a man are not to be in opposition to the fruit of the Spirit. They're to be in harmony. That's the man's struggle. James 3, when it talks about the wisdom that's from above, James 3, 17 through 19. The wisdom that's from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, willing to yield, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality and without hypocrisy. That's the man's struggle, is to live in harmony with those verses while still having these characteristics that are great strengths. But it's only by having those other characteristics that I just mentioned in these verses that keep these things in line to where they do not become weaknesses, but become the godly strengths they were intended to be. And that's difficult from time to time. So the role of a father, when you think about it in general, 1 Timothy 2 and verse 8, I think is a great verse. Guys, read 1 Timothy 2 verse 8 constantly, because men are supposed to be praying everywhere, lifting up holy hands to God, without wrath and without doubting. Passages such as Titus chapter 2, starting at verse 2, the older men, men, be sober, be reverent, be temperate, sound in faith, in love, and patience. The young men, verse 6, to be sober-minded. Paul tells Titus to, in all things, show yourself to be a pattern of good works. In doctrine, showing integrity, reverence, incorruptibility, sound speech that cannot be condemned, that one who is an opponent may be ashamed, having nothing evil to say to you. Men, you are the one who is supposed to be the example of what godliness and integrity, this strength and this character, putting all of these great traits that have the ability to crush someone else, to live in harmony with the gentleness and the loving kindness of our God, to show to the world, and especially to our families, what it means to be a godly man. Bless you who had those kinds of dads and those fathers. That kind of example that God actually intended for them to be. Because in the home, God does have expectations. We're going to look at Ephesians 5 in just a moment, but 1 Peter 3 and verse 7 says that men are to dwell with their wives with understanding, to give honor to her and treat her as this weaker vessel. And if we don't, God says, I'm not going to listen to your prayers, because you're denying what you were created to be. It is not contrary to your character to be this way. If you can't be this way, that's what's contrary to your character. A man in the home is supposed to be ruling his household, it says in 1 Timothy 3 and verse 4. His household in such a way that the kids are raised with reverence or gravity, a great seriousness for the things of God. And also, as Colossians 3 verse 19 says, that when fathers raise their children, it says in Colossians 3 and verse 19, husbands, love your wives and do not be bitter toward them. And verse 21, fathers, do not provoke your children, lest they become discouraged. Ruling with reverence and self-control. There to be nurturing godliness in the home. Ephesians 6 and verse 4, the idea that comes to mind to me that I've said many times from this verse, developing an appetite. You nurture that. When you see that thing within your child that shows them and proves to them that there is someone that is higher, that is greater, that there is a God that is there, and those things of godliness. You start seeing this around the age of, I don't know, 7, 8, 9 years old, I guess. When they get to 12 or 13, it really is a voracious appetite if they've been raised among godly people. Nurture that appetite. Don't squash it. Don't discourage them. Don't defeat them before they ever fight the battle. When you see that thing that they have that appetite for, nurture it. For the time we have remaining, Ephesians 5. Ephesians 5. The role of the father as a husband. Starting at verse 22. Wives, submit to your own husbands as to the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife, he says. The word head that's there, I think many times that we have really robbed it of what it's supposed to mean. So many times we as men will look at that word and we think about that respect aspect of it this way. I get the final word. When it comes to who decides what the color of the drapes are going to be, it's my word. It's me, because I'm the head. Men, we really demean that term when we do things like that. You don't get respect by demanding it. You don't get it by forcing it. The word that's used here for head is used to describe Christ as the head of the church. He has that authority, yes. Absolutely. But when you look at Colossians chapter 2 and verse 19, Paul says this, Colossians 2 and verse 19, that in not holding fast to the head, from whom the whole body, nourished and knit together by joints and ligaments, grows with increase that is from God. The head is the one who encourages development. That's what it means for you to be the head. You were given that authority for that purpose, not so that you could be the one who decides what color carpet you have in your house. It was to supply the rest of the body, your wife, with nourishment so that she might be built up in those things. That means you initiate and you encourage that development. The way that you do that, guys, is that if your wife isn't going to the ladies' Bible study, you encourage her to do so. The way that's done is if your wife is going to the ladies' Bible study and she's never taught class before, you let her know, you know what, honey? You would do a great job in teaching a lesson on service, hospitality, anything that is particular to the women's issues that are being studied, and you encourage her to do that. She's never taught class before, you encourage her to do that. You let her know how good she would be at it. And you specifically point out to her why she would be good at that. That's your job as the head. That's what it means to be the head. Because that's how Christ is with His body, the church. So you initiate that and you do that. Also in verse 23, as Christ also is head of the church and He is the Savior of the body. That means He bears the burdens of the body. Men, we have that responsibility and that great task of saving that Christ had for the church. That means we protect from all those negative consequences that may come. Those fall on your shoulders. You bear that burden. You go through Isaiah 53 and notice how many times it talks about Christ bearing for the sins of mankind. But it wasn't just the sins themselves, but it was the stripes, it was the beatings, it was the insults. If those things come, they come to you because you were created with the ability to withstand them. That's not for your wife. That's for you. You're the burden bearer in the home. Verse 24. Therefore, just as Christ is, the church is subject to Christ, so let the wives be to their own husbands in everything. Husbands, love your wives, just as Christ also loved the church. Do you think the church was at the center of Christ's attention as He lived? How focused do you think Jesus was on the church as He lived His life? That's what your wife is supposed to be. You want to protect yourself from the stuff that Sean's going to talk about tonight? You make your wife the center of your universe. You love her that much like Christ loved the church, and see if it doesn't protect you. And you see the kind of respect that you'll be given for such as that. What we love becomes the center of our attention. Also in verse 25 it says, and He gave Himself for His wife. That means husbands, we are the ones that do without. We are the ones who are supposed to discipline ourselves and give up our time and the things that we want so that our wife might have it. That's our role. Verse 26, that He might sanctify and cleanse her with the washing of the water by the Word. In other words, Christ sees what is good in the body and He expects the best that is there. He is the one that presents her as this glorious body. It says in verse 27 that He might present her to Himself as a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing but that she should be holy and without blemish. Christ exalts the church. Guys, when's the last time you talked praising your wife? And not just in private, but also publicly. Christ didn't just praise the church in a corner. He exalted the church. The manifold wisdom of God is going to be made known to the world by what? The church. The way in which you talk, the way in which you praise and honor and exalt your wife, that's how much we know about your home in that same fashion. Verse 28, so husbands ought to love their own wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. He shares in her pain. He shares in her joys. As my own body. Sympathetic to what's going on with her. Verse 29, for no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it just as the Lord does the church. In other words, He seeks to fulfill her every need. Guys, verse 29 is so important because we as men are supposed to be able to detect the emotional and physical needs of our wives. Dwell with understanding, remember? She's the weaker vessel, remember? That means we're supposed to know what's going on with our wives. We're supposed to be able to detect that and respond to that, just as it is that Christ gave everything to fulfill every need that the church has. What need do we have as a church that Christ did not do everything within His power to fulfill? He nourished the church. Husbands, that's our task. But not just nourishes, but He cherishes that. That means that it is motivated by affection. Not just agape love. It is motivated by cherishing. It is motivated by affection for that wife. She is the center of your world. Ladies, the guy sitting next to you, you are the center of his world. And if you think about how much it is that Christ Jesus loved the church, your husband loves you that much. Now, how secure, how loved would you feel? How much respect would you have for that kind of guy? One of the things that is so often said, I don't know if my husband loves me. And I really need my husband to be a leader. There's our blueprint, guys. This is our Proverbs 31. This is that virtuous man that every woman is looking for. The ideal, as Christ loved the church. And finally, verse 30. For we are members of His body, of His flesh, and of His bones. We are so made into one. We love the wife as much as we love ourselves, so much that we are constantly in communication. As the body cannot be separated from the parts of the body, so it is with us. So we communicate, and that joy that comes with that. So I want you to think for just a moment. Genesis 2, it became a curse. Wife, you will have a desire for your husband, and your husband will rule over you. Ephesians 5 is, wives, be submissive to your husbands. Husbands, love your wives. You see that change that's there? That thing at the beginning that became such a curse, God reveals in the New Testament, Ephesians 5, how that curse is lifted. You want to be like it was meant to be in the very beginning? Stop living like Genesis chapter 3 and start living like Ephesians chapter 5. Quit trying to force your husband or coerce your husband into loving you. And husbands, quit trying to force your wives to be submissive to you. You were commanded to love her. She was commanded to be submissive to you. I do my role. She does her role. We're not Genesis 3 anymore. We're more like Genesis chapter 1 and Genesis chapter 2. We're like Christ with the church. Fathers, God bless you. Many of you have been great examples to me. You've been great fathers, great brothers to me, and you give me a lot of encouragement and a lot of instruction along the way. So today, let it be a day that you will indeed thank God for the Father that you've been given. You've been very patient with me as we're going through this. I hope it's been a benefit to you. More than anything else, let it be something of a benchmark. If there's something in your house that needs to be taken care of, fathers, it's your role. It's your responsibility to take care of that. That child that you have that may be outside the home now, yes, they're outside the home. They're outside of your authority, but you're still their father. And just as it was with Abraham, he set the course for a family lineage. If your child is still drawing breath, it's not too late. Do something about that. You're a father. God gave you that role. Do not be ashamed of it. Raise your sons to be godly men, not feminine. They're not meant to be feminine. Raise them to be men and to not be ashamed of it. Let them have those characteristics that do have the temptation to be weaknesses if not careful, but raise them with that same parameter of the fruits of the Spirit and the wisdom that's from above. Let them be men as God intended. And let's show the world what it's supposed to look like when a godly man and a godly woman truly love each other as God intended. I hope, as I said, this has been an encouragement to you. If you need to respond to the gospel because maybe you haven't been a godly father or you haven't been a godly spouse in whatever capacity, if there's something that we can do, let us help. We have good, godly men and women in this congregation that know how to help. Let it be known, if you will. Together we stand and sing this song.